Well, welcome to Conversation 19, which is based on a really interesting book.
Every now and again, you find a gem, something that just puts a lot of your life and your experiences in perspective. And this book that was recommended to me by Jeannie Shaw has really fulfilled that in our lives.
And you're the one who told me about it. And the author is Sky Jatani, and the book is With. Well, the full name is With, Reimagining the Way You Relate to God, which is a great title, but we just referred to it as With.
Yeah, it's been really illuminating, I think, for us to read this book. And, you know, we've been talking about this ministry of Fair Havens, the ministry of hope that we've really been involved with in this last year. And this book, sometimes when you're anchored in a situation, it's really good to look back a little bit at the journey and how you got there and where you've come from. And this book has done that for us, I think.
And as the title says, With, it's about a relationship with God. And I could admit quite easily that so often in the past, I've spoken or even preached about a personal relationship with God when often it didn't actually feel that personal.
Well, I think often we define a personal relationship with God by putting it in a box and calling it a quiet time. So it became,
right.
Could you measure it? Had you had it every day? How long did you pray? How much did you read? Did you journal? Different things like that.
I'm not good at journaling. Yeah, or how many times you've read the whole Bible? How many guests did you bring to the meeting? And this book is so different. I think it just struck many chords. In us. I'm so glad you recommended it to me. I've read it twice. I may read it a third time. It's really good.
Yeah, when Doug reads a book more than once, I really sit up and take note.
No, this year there have been three books I've read twice. They actually all kind of fit together. They're all very relational.
Yeah, you get that sense that God is working and opening our eyes. So it's exciting when you find something. And we just really wanted to share that with you. We're soon actually going to be participating in a retreat that is based around this book. And we're all going to read the book before we go. And then the whole idea is to share with each other at the retreat what we are learning and how we're putting it into practice and what we've seen, how we've grown through this process of really walking with God.
Now, Jatani is very insightful. I mean, I describe the book as is profound, it's insightful, but it's easy. It's really simple. And he identifies different postures towards God. He uses a different preposition for each one. So he speaks of life over God, life under God, life from God, and life for God. And that's all in contrast to the healthy posture, which is life with God. And we're not going to give away the whole book and do it too much summarizing, but I do want to at least be able to introduce these four, the unhealthy patterns, and probably because I see in myself each of those wrong postures.
Well, me too. Yeah. I mean, I think it's part of this book starts out, and I think this will resonate with a lot of us, that our hearts seek God and the goodness, the beauty, justice, and peace we've been told he will provide. But he often remains hidden behind the shadow cast by an evil world. He says, my concern is that we are inoculating an entire generation to the Christian faith. Many come with a holy desire to know God, to experience his presence in their lives, to be cared for like sheep entrusted to a meek and gentle shepherd. But this is not what they see or experience.
Right. I mean, our faith is relational. It's about God. It's not about some program. He speaks of life over God. Now, this is the approach marked by foolproof formulas and methods. We want to guarantee the right income, and we effectively cut out the middleman, and that's God. So we're in charge. We're in control. We're at the helm. Life over God.
Well, it's almost like we sometimes will try and look for spiritual insights or biblical principles that we can start to implement and will apply to ministry or ministry training or something along those lines that's going to help us be more productive, and we'll gauge whether we're doing well by the outcome.
Right, and there's a bottom line, numerical, it's financial, or numbers of members or converts. It, as Jatani points out, this fits in really well with the culture of self-help. It's like, you know, just show me how to do it, and then I want to manage it. I want to control the outcomes. And I remember a friend in Australia used to often say, you can't manage the outcome. I mean, you have to leave that to God.
Right. God is not to be manipulated, and God is not either trying to manipulate us, but we live in a world where we're always trying to get something out of someone or something. Oh, yes. And so we fall into that very easily.
Well, that's life over God. Now, life under God, it's similar in that it also can be mechanical, but it's a little different. It's not so much about being controlled, being in the driver's seat, but it's an emphasis of cause and effect. If we follow the rules, we do what God tells us to do, you know, we show up to church, we go to midweek, put your money in the plate, participate in the rituals, then somehow the Lord owes us, you know, which is, I guess, really common in many religions. You do something, it doesn't matter how you live contrary to that, as long as you go through the right rituals, God's going to take care of you. And that's life under God.
I think that's also what we experience in the business world, the financial worlds, that, you know, it's like you just follow the rules, it's mathematical. We like it because it's very black and white. It doesn't really deal with the gray. Yeah. And as a result, it leads to disappointment. I've seen this especially in young people, I think. You know, they're like, I came to church, I became a Christian, I followed the rules, I met this person, I'm dating this person, therefore I should get married. And, you know, there's this idea that it's all going to work out on this nice line, this nice continuum. And when it doesn't, it's devastating to the faith because that's tied up. But it's not really about really seeking God or being a part of his plan. It's about trying to make his plan your plan and your ideas. Right.
So, you know, life over God, we're kind of, God's almost beneath us. Life under God, yeah, he's up there and we just do what he says. And so we expect that he'll come through. But this is not realistic. This is not the world that the Bible speaks of, nor is it the real world where things are black and white and work out. The real world has all kinds of bumps.
Right. And the real world, and we know it's relational, which this is what we're leaning towards, yeah.
It's so sad when you see younger people leaving. Sometimes I'll talk to younger Christians and I'll say, so it's been a hard time. How long have you been a Christian? And they'll give me a number and it's inevitably just a few years. I said, it's not even been a decade. I mean, this is a decades long thing. It's not just a few years. Hang in there. And yet it's hard to hang in there when you constantly hear messages that suggest it's so simple that if it's not working out for you, you're doing something wrong.
Well, and I think, yeah, and then the implication is that it's sin and people are just so down on themselves
right. When
it may not be God's timing, but we don't think of that because we're thinking this should be like a math class.
Well, then there's life from God. So we've done life over and under. Life from God focuses on the blessings more than on God. This is like the name it and claim it prosperity theology. Jeremiah 29:11, but not verse 10. It's, you know, think it and it will be yours. You know, whatever you pray for, you will receive. So it too is flat and mechanical, but it's focused on getting what we can out of God, which reminds us of a certain character in the New Testament.
Right. The prodigal son. Well, yeah. The two sons actually are always quite interesting to study. But I think that it's not just the prosperity theology. It's in most of our minds today and our thinking that if I'm a good person, I do the right things, mm-hmm. then in some ways I'm owed this as well. I mean, it's an interesting balance, isn't it?
So, yes, that's similar to the previous posture, really just trying to get whatever we can out of God. And that's not loving when it's all about taking.
Right. And we see it in society today with this individualism, you know, that's just pushing forwards, like, what can I get?
What's in it for me, that attitude? But
even a little bit of entitlement. I mean, I think that comes in there as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I deserve my...
He felt he deserved his inheritance before.
Well, and, you know, the prosperity preachers will say, you know, you're a princess or you're a prince. You know, you're the son of the great king, and he wants you to, you know, have a life of luxury and and privilege, which is not at all what the Bible says. But then there's life for God, and you'd say, well, what could be wrong with living for God? Well, as Chaitanya explains it, this is, it's very involved, it's very bound up with the notion of achievement, accomplishing things for God, doing great things. And I'll quote him, "What I find most among my peers in Christian ministry is a highly activist form of faith." And what he means by this, let me give another quotation from later on. Is that okay? "Some great goal, understood to be initiated by God and carried forward by us, defines everything and everyone. An individual is either on the mission, the object of the mission, an obstacle to the mission, an aid to the mission, or a fat Christian who should be on the mission."
Yeah, and I almost, or providing some money for the mission. Maybe we can add one.
Yeah. So it kind of, I thought of, that's kind of like a sermon outline. All right, you're on the mission, or you're the object of the mission. That is, you're not a Christian yet, or you're an
That kind of reminds me of most conferences I've attended in the past, that's the purpose. And sometimes we have, and I think this resonated with us a lot, that you know, you can just, we did that lesson on the lens of Matthew 28, and this is what that's referring to, is that we just look through everything as to, we've got to seek and save the lost, and
but
nothing else counts.
Great. We're going to do great things for God. But, yeah. As the author says,
it for puts, God, though.
For God. Yes, for God. It puts God's mission ahead of God himself. You say, what about Paul? Well, Chaitanya replies, Paul, this most celebrated missionary, did not make this mistake. I mean, when you read Paul, it's all about God. It's not about the bottom line.
Yes, and it's all about what he does in Christ Jesus as well. I mean, that phrase comes up so much in the New Testament letters.
But if people ever give personal examples from their life or from others, what do they do? Who is celebrated? Listen to Chaitanya. The life for God posture is highly celebrated. Those capable of accomplishing the most receive great accolades and admiration. It's a culture of achievement.
Yeah. I've also seen it cloaked sometimes as being asked at the beginning of the year, perhaps there's new resolutions, and they're saying, what's your vision for God? Like we've got that all backwards. It's, well, what's God's vision for us?
That's well.
But you hear that a lot, like we've got to provide something for God.
We have another juicy quote here. You want to read that one?
Right. "Many of the people accomplishing the most for God seem to reflect his character at the least. Rather than being marked by peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, and love, many of them were anxious, impatient, rude, aggressive, and sometimes even spiteful." Similarly, there is an eerie correlation between their meanness and how absolutely certain a person is about their beliefs. Those who pride themselves or their church fellowship on their reverent submission to God's truth are strangely reluctant to submit to anyone else.
That hit me, because if I get all involved in my agenda, and I would deny I'm ever anxious, but you know I must be, then that's when the mean side could come out. There's a lack of gentleness and love, and the higher performer you are, the higher achiever you are, the more you might get away with it, because, well, we want to celebrate those who are highly productive. So I understand how these things can go together. That makes sense. And in my own life, I've seen that. I don't want it. But that correlation between meanness and absolute certainty about our beliefs, I don't think Chaitanya is saying we shouldn't be confident. You don't read it that way, do you?
No, but I think this is what so many of us have experienced, is that the higher up we see people in church leadership, we find them to be rude. They're impatient. They never have time, because their agenda comes across as being more spiritual and more important. I think that's what it's talking about. And it's very sad, because I think it's also, that typifies a person who can't admit that they may have made a mistake,
right,
or apologize, or just to say, you know what, I was wrong. I was impatient. You know, there's usually a way to make other people feel like, well, you didn't catch me at the right time. Or, you know, da-da-da. This is, blame shifting happens.
And maybe just to balance it a little bit, I don't think it's the case that everybody in leadership is mean, or the higher up someone is, the more certain he is to be dogmatic and pushy. But it is a correlation. And even when people are pushy or mean, they may sometimes admit it. But the character doesn't, the behavior doesn't really change. So I think he's right on target here.
Well, I think so. And I also know different people have different experiences with different leaders. But my experience has been a lot of times that I have seen, felt times people have been very rude and impatient with me. Okay. And I sadly have probably been the same with others. I admit to that.
Well, there are some there are other things about this posture, this life for God. Again, we're saying, are we living for God? But what's really going on? He says, life for God takes our fear of insignificance and throws gasoline on it. So some may have low self-esteem, but the sense that they're on a mission for God makes them feel valuable and important. And so their identity and their sense of worth is rooted in behavior more than in God. So he says that this posture takes our fear of insignificance, throws gasoline on it. The resulting fire may be presented to the world as godly ambition, a holy desire to see God's mission advance, the kind of drive evident in the Apostle Paul's life. But when these flames are fueled by fear, they reveal none of the peace, joy, or love displayed by Paul. The relentless drive to prove our worth can quickly become destructive.
Hmm.
Wow. And before long, the mission controls almost everything. Time, relationships, health, spiritual depth, ethics, and convictions, and advanced stages. This means doing whatever it takes to solve the problem. In its worst iteration, the end always justifies the means. The family goes, health is sacrificed, integrity is jeopardized, God connection is limited. I think it's a little bit like maybe the older son just trudging on, you know, all these years slaving for his father. But there's a lack of joy and relationship.
Yeah, you see that sense of duty in that older son and from Luke 15. And he's so confused as to why the younger brother gets welcomed back. I mean, he's not able to see grace. He's not able to even receive, sadly.
No, he just thinks it's unfair.
Yes.
There's no grace here. You know, Jatani, he's writing for all Christians, but in a special way, particularly under this fourth posture, I think, for leaders. And he comments, when church leaders function from this understanding of the Christian faith, Christian life, they invariably transfer their burden and fears to those in the pews. He says, if a pastor's sense of worth is linked to the impact of his or her ministry, guess what believers under that pastor's care are told is most important? People who believe their value is linked to their accomplishments. That's the result. That anxiety. I think of probably many messages I've done. And not just since I've been independent. I've worked for the church for 20 years, been independent more than 20 years. But even in the second period, not working for the church, I'm wondering how much have I transferred my anxiety or burdens I've felt to the audience instead of really presenting Christ. It's quite a searching question for a preacher.
Well, it is, because it's we're wanting to see the mission. We're wanting to see people come to Christ, which is part of what God wants our lives to reflect as
sure.
well, to spread the gospel. But at the same time, it shouldn't be, you know, that you're twisting, manipulating, you're making people so become a Christian out of fear. I fear you're going to hell. That's the reason. But
or,
I think,
or perform out of fear.
Yes. You know, or feeling like, hey, my job is on the line if I don't have good statistics. Oh. And I think that can be very
for
real
staff
as well.
Members, yeah.
For staff people, yes.
Absolutely. So these are the four unhealthy postures. And he quite boldly says his introduction before he unpacks them. People are offered a substitute form of Christianity, one that cannot break through the shadows and never really satisfies the deepest longing of their souls. Mm. And, you know, with life over God, under God, from mm. God, for God, they're really missing something, aren't they?
Well, I think we have to admit we have missed some things. I mean, we see a huge number of people really digging in now to understand how we can be spiritually formed.
right,
into Christ-likeness, and spiritual formation and spiritual development. We're all reading many, many books on this because we've realized somehow we've missed the mark. I don't believe it was intentional, but this book helps give us a place or a point of reference, I think.
I thought it did. It does a great job. But all these postures are based on fear and control somehow. You know, over God, there's the manipulation. Under God, you know, we're just trying to just do
principles, empirical formulas.
Yeah, from God, you know, God's the dispenser of all blessings.
The cosmic bellhop who's going to appear and help us out. Yes.
And for God, we're achieving great things. We say we're doing it for God.
We're changing the world in one generation. Perhaps that's the rally cry
there. Are we changing the world? And
well, is that what we're called to do?
Is it coming out of some deep insecurity in ourselves?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, we believe that the church has the power to change the world because Christ lives in the church. But it's about Christ. It's not about the people.
Right.
Well, then, of course, we come to life with God. And the second half of the book, I mean, both halves are great. We're not going to really talk about the second half. But this is true relationship. And God is love. God is eternal love because there's love among the persons of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit. And that divine love overflows into our lives. And when God creates us in Genesis, it's not to do his work for him, like a lot of the pagan gods did in the old religions, but it's for relationship, to be with him in the garden.
Right. You're not going to be on your own on some mission. This is very clearly that it's a partnership here, and we are
right
in this together.
Right. And that God being with us is one of the most precious promises through the Old Covenant and the New Covenant and our ultimate goal of heaven or the New Jerusalem. Yeah. It's all about being with God.
Very end of the age. That's
and
what we look forward to. That's what we should, that's the hope that we have.
This is satisfying.
Yeah.
And I love the way, if you don't mind me doing one more.
No, go ahead.
This quote here. he's very hard hitting. And if you're a church leader or you used to be, you'll relate to this for sure. But I've got a feeling anyone who's been around the church for a while will get this. All right. The primary purpose of our worship gatherings, preaching, and program should be to present a ravishing vision of Jesus Christ. When people come to see who he is and what God is like, treasuring him becomes the natural outcome. But in many places, the vision of Christ remains hidden behind shadows, while lesser glories, often some variation on the culture's values or the church's mission, are given the spotlight. And then we scratch our heads in bewilderment when people leave the church disappointed and unsatisfied or fail to engage. "My congregation needs a swift kick in the tail to share their faith," one pastor told me. What his people probably need is a clear vision of who Christ really is, a vision I'm guessing the pastor needs as well.
Right.
I love the way you put that.
Well, and I think it's really thinking about if someone is very special to you and you see your friend, you want to introduce these two friends together. And if that was what was happening at church, is Jesus is special.
Wonderful.
He's my friend. Right here, we're with this. I want you to meet him. And I want to tell you about his father as well. And that if it was that kind of an introduction, it would be so exciting. It's nice to meet new people. But
right. But this system and these other postures, they're just,
right,
they're systems that fall short.
Yeah.
And anyway, the second half of the book fleshes out what life with God looks like. He's got chapters on God, faith, hope, and love. And even though we're getting near the end of this conversation, the next one, conversation 20, will also be based on with. After we participated in the retreat, we know there'll be lots of great ideas. And hopefully we'll see some things, experience some things as a result of that retreat,
yeah,
from the brothers and sisters.
And we want to be able to share those because I think that's how we grow, is sharing. There's not one formula that just says this is how you have a relationship with God. Is that we will, each one of us, individually experience him in one way to be with him. As a group, we'll experience how to be with him as well. And we're looking forward to that.
Very much. Well, we have one more quote. Do you want to?
No, go ahead.
Let me do it? Okay. And this is about the cross. Jesus did not die merely to inaugurate a mission, life for God, or to give us a second chance at life, life from God. He did not endure the horrors of the cross just to demonstrate a principle of life for others to emulate, life over God, or to appease divine wrath, life under God. While each of these may be rooted in truth and affirmed by Scripture, it's only when we grasp God's unyielding desire to be with us that we begin to see the ultimate purpose of the cross. It's more than a vehicle to rescue us from death. The cross transports us into the arms of life. The cross is how we acquire our treasure. It is how we find unity with God.
That's so powerful, because that really is the purpose of Jesus' death, was to give us that unity with his Father.
It's all about the relationship. And this is a book that I think is helping me to become more relational, to rethink God. And, you know, that subtitle of the book, Reimagining the Way You Relate to God. What wonderful words. We look forward to sharing with you in a little while after we've been at this retreat, and we'll have some more things to say. So thank you for listening.
And we'll share more about how to be with God next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.